Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 12th of March, 2012, here in Japan. Today, I'm joined on the line once again from the United States by Bill Conroy, an investigative journalist whose work is featured at Narco News, narconews.com. Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us once again.
Yeah, glad to be with you guys.
Well, I want to go over today a very important and very worrying new report that you have. U.S. troops may now be coping with fast and furious fallout and all of the ramifications of that story. But before we get into that, perhaps we should make sure that everyone's on the same page, and perhaps you can lead in to talk us through not only Fast and Furious, but also some of the forerunner programs that existed in the Bush administration before the Obama administration even got in.
Yeah, well, the Fast and Furious was essentially a program where the ATF was allowing gun smugglers to purchase weapons in the United States at gun stores and, you know, gun shows, wherever they could get them. And, you know, knowing that they were buying these and then allowing the smugglers to take them across the border into Mexico and to the cartels, and primarily the Sinaloa cartel, it appears, is where the majority of these guns went. And the idea was, which is kind of insane, is that somehow after the fact, they would, you know, trace these weapons and be able to make cases against the higher ups in the cartels. The problem with that is they never told the Mexican government they were doing this. So it would be hard for the Mexican government to really help them out on across the border. The ATF has no law enforcement power in Mexico. And once the guns cross the border, they just disappeared. I mean, they could go a thousand different ways. So really it was kind of a boggled operation. It's not clear if that was by intention, and they really wanted the guns to go there, that there was some other, you know, larger purpose to this, or it was just ineptness on the part of law enforcement agencies. The Fast and Furious was the program that we're hearing about now in the news, and that's been running, or had been running, since about the fall of 2009. And it was done in conjunction with the FBI and the DEA and ICE. It was a joint task force program, but ATF's end was this gun running thing. And they were all aiming to make cases. So there was a lot of turf wars and a lot of, Keystone Cop type of stuff going on that could have explained why this happened. But at the end of the day, it really was not a very well thought out. In fact, it was a disastrous program that led to a lot of Mexicans getting murdered. And before that, you know, what we discovered and what has come out in the media is that this program is like this, these gun running programs. And the reason they call them, gun walking is essentially they're allowing the guns to walk, after they watch them purchased and know who got them, they let the perps walk with the guns. And a similar program was run under the Bush administration going back to 2006. It's called a wide receiver. Same kind of modus operandi. And, you know, recently we talked to an ATF source who told us this program, originally they thought it was only run out of Phoenix across the Arizona border. Well, apparently it was also being run across the New Mexico border. And there was a case made there about a year ago whereby they busted most of the town leaders in this little town on the border on the U.S. side called Columbus, who were all involved with gun running, including the police chief and the mayor and the village trustee. And in that particular case, there were at least 150, if not more, guns that were known to have disappeared. And they disappeared after the investigation was started. And at least 15 of those guns were later found in Mexico by the Mexican government at crime scenes. And, six of them tied to murders. Eight people were murdered with six of those guns. So that's just six of the guns. And in Fast and Furious on the Arizona border, there were a couple thousand. They really don't know how many guns walked. Those are the estimates. The odds are it was more. And there is some evidence that this was also allowed to happen along the Texas border, a case we followed for quite some time, Sully Castillo, who was a former DEA agent who had been claiming for quite some time that he thought they were corrupt ATF agents, but that they were allowing guns into Mexico. And he ended up, it's a long story, but he got arrested for on gun charges and convicted, basically because he didn't have the right paperwork. But the long and short of it is he had been, and we had reported on the fact that something was going on along the Texas border where apparently guns were being allowed to be, you know, shipped across the border in large quantities and were ending up somewhere in the hands of the Mexican drug organizations. So this is the gist of it. You have this massive flow of weapons, essentially sanctioned by the U.S. government or ATF. And we don't know how high up it went. We can argue about that. Who authorized this? Which agencies beyond ATF really were involved, and how high up in the government this went. But it's clear it was an ongoing program, at least back to 2006, which ironically is the same time Calderon came into office. President Felipe Calderon of Mexico came into office in late 2006 and declared his war on the cartels. In other words, he was going to clean up Mexico and get rid of the cartels. And so he's waging this big war at the same time as this flow of weapons is coming south, most of it, from what we can tell, going to the Sinaloa cartel, which ironically now has become arguably the dominant cartel in Mexico, and where this was happening along the border. There's an area called Juarez that's south of El Paso in Texas, and it goes over to New Mexico. It was Columbus and Palamas, and then they go over to Nogales in Arizona. That whole stretch from Nogales basically to Juarez, El Paso, is where all this was happening, and it crosses, you know, essentially for sure two states, a little bit of Texas. And the Sinaloa cartels basically, you know, taken over that territory from another dominant player that was there for years, at least on the El Paso side, was the Juarez cartel. And we had done some reporting when we actually, one of the former cartel, well, he's in hiding right now, but he's a former cartel member who had worked for the Juarez cartel and kind of told us about one of the guys, Mufaro, who was just busted in Mexico a couple months back, who had originally worked for the Juarez cartel and then switched sides and went to the Sinaloa cartel, and was you know, essentially had a reputation for being a bit of a murderer. He was using his knowledge of the Juarez cartel to finger folks that were operating these drug trafficking routes for the Juarez cartel, so the Sinaloa cartel could take them out. And it's probably no coincidence that particular individual, Mufaro, about a year ago, they found a stash of weapons in Juarez in a house that belonged to him. There were 40 of them that were traced back to Fast and Furious. So you have these connections where you find the Sinaloa cartel, you know, kind of rising to dominance with a lot of firepower at the same time this operation's going on. And whether that's by design or by accident, we don't know. We do know that there's a guy in trial in Chicago right now, named Zambada, who is the son of one of the leaders of the Sinaloa cartel. He claims that the Sinaloa cartel had a deal with the U.S. government whereby they would rat out their rival cartels in exchange for essential immunity from being busted, or and also information on how to avoid arrest in Mexico when the Mexican government was looking for them. Mind you, the Mexican government's plenty corrupt too, so they have their players there helping them out. So essentially, this Zambada guy was on trial, the son of the leader of the Sinaloa cartel. He's claiming that Fast and Furious is evidence and was part of this agreement that these guns were, in fact, on purpose given to the Sinaloa cartel to accomplish the very thing that they've accomplished, which is to monopolize the drug routes along the northern border between, released between Texas and Arizona. And from what we can tell, and from what, I guess, if you read the newspapers and from having been there, it definitely, besides Juarez being the most violent city, that while this was all going on, there's, you know, Juarez became essentially a war zone. And there has been, and it's always hard to tell because people, you know, wear uniforms, they don't tell you, you know, I work for the Sinaloa cartel. But it does appear that the Chapo Guzman and Ismael Zambada were the head of the Sinaloa, the leaders, they keep this organization moving, do now have more control, far more control in that area.
Well, let's move to the latest reports. And as I mentioned, you have a new report up on narconews.com. U.S. troops may now be coping with Fast and Furious fallout, referencing a couple of different sources talking about U.S. troop movements along the U.S.-Mexican border. Perhaps you can talk about that and how it ties into this story.
Yeah, well, we reported that, I don't know, a week ago, but and there hasn't been any national coverage of it, but there's been some local border papers that have reported that they've moved in about 500 troops, active duty troops. Nobody really knows why they're there. They claim they're there just to kind of support. This is a Joint Task Force North, which is there to support and protect the U.S. border, but also to support Border Patrol. But basically what our sources are telling us is we've had special operations forces active along the border and even inside Mexico going back at least to 2009. Now, these people were there mostly, it weren't large numbers. They were doing, kind of reconnaissance and intelligence gathering and assisting Mexican troops and Mexican special forces with operations, that kind of thing. And now, we haven't been able to get the paperwork on this, but the claim was, and this we reported on in the last week, but we had known about it for a while, was that these special operations folks, and they were there, maybe teams of four and five, what have you, were reporting that there was a massive flow of guns going across the border into Mexico, and they had allegedly contacted the Department of Justice, State Department, asked if there's some kind of operation going on, and never got a response. And of course, around that time frame, that's exactly when Fast and Furious was going on. So they had run across this trail of iron going south from the United States, and it was making it a little sticky for them because there was a lot more firepower down there. What happened in the last, and I just don't have the story in front of me, so I'm guessing in the time frame of the last week or two, is there were troops dispatched, to the border area, and essentially between that route that I talked about, the drug trafficking route along the border there between Nogales and Palomas, Columbus, and in just to the west of Juarez, is the stretch of border that they're positioned on, and there's armored vehicle carriers there, and again, they're not saying why they're there. They're saying they're there just to support. But our understanding is that embedded in those troops are some additional special operation folks, and they are doing some missions down there across the border. And we still don't really know what that is. There have been rumors of arms stashes along some of the backwoods areas there. In that that whole area has been a trafficking route, and the guns go south and the drugs come north, and along the way there's stash like sites for transporting this stuff.
Well, given that this Fast and Furious scandal has now reached all the way up the chain of the ladder and is affecting even the Attorney General Holder and all the different levels of the Department of Justice, why do you think there's still this continuing secrecy about the border operations? Don't you think that anyone would have learned the lesson that this type of secrecy is what's causing a lot of the problems for the officials involved in these programs?
Yeah, I can't answer that 100%, but I could tell you my suspicions is the relationship between the United States and Mexico has always been rather delicate, especially when it comes to anything to do with the military, anything to do with the potential perception that the United States is putting force inside Mexico it's just a long history of Mexico not trusting the United States in military endeavors. And from what I understand, the special operations we talked about, they are in cooperation with the Mexican military. So there's the element that the Mexican government doesn't want this out and known, because they right now have a major movement on their hands against the drug war, mass movement, nonviolent movement to end the drug war. Indicating that they've now ramped up and are conducting joint operations with the U.S. military to, fight the drug war, politically is probably not the thing they want to do. And I think in general, the drug war, what's happened with a lot of the policy, people at the top aren't stupid either, and they know it's not working. They have to know it's not working, but there's a bit of real politic involved in that. If the drug trade were to collapse, if they actually did stop it, which isn't going to happen, but the reality is it would collapse Mexico. I mean, it's a major part of their economy. So there's a lot of covert and hidden actions that go on that behind the scenes that really, if they were played out in public, I think would discredit or discredit the drug war for one, but also probably put a lot of folks that are in office in the hot seat. And, you know, maybe they think they're doing the best thing. If they really did have to change course here, and, you know, Mexico would collapse by some reason if they either shut down all the drug trade or if they legalized it, you know, what would happen? I guess there's really only drastic actions to be taken if you don't continue this course. And this course is just replete with this kind of idiocy, where you have policies that, won't work, but you continue to pursue them. And it happens administration after administration, and it just keeps going on. And you get away with it to a certain degree. You know, people think, you can't cover things up. I actually get a kick out of that. Well, what you just said, that, well, they should have learned that you can't cover things up. That's the worst thing to do. The reality is most stuff does get covered. It's rare when it does come out, and even when it does, it gets eventually nothing really comes of it. You can go back to Iran-Contra. What really came of that? Well, what came of it is everyone that came forward and testified, or most of the whistleblowers, were either persecuted and otherwise had their careers ruined, or their testimonies at Congress. I mean, anytime someone goes to testify in Congress, they can classify it, in which case, once it's classified, even they can't tell their own story without breaking the law. So there's a lot of that goes on. So they in fact can cover this up, and they in fact usually often do and normally get away with it. It's rare that they don't. So at least from what I can see.
Unfortunately so. And of course, you mentioned the drug war and its effects in the U.S. Obviously, it's a failed policy that has been demonstrably failed for basically since its inception. But it's becoming increasingly clear when you look at the statistics. And I note that your most recent Narco News article is drug war-related homicides in the U.S. average at least 1,100 a year, which is a statistic that you don't see cited anywhere in the mainstream media. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about the effect of the drug war in the U.S.
Well, I'm glad you actually read that. I'm surprised you did. I just went up yesterday. One of the questions I had, and that's precisely why I had it, is I couldn't find any figures on the homicide rate, murder rate, directly tied to the drug war, drug smuggling, etc. As I started digging into it, I ran across this Congressional Research Service report that said, well, you're not going to find it because we looked for it. It doesn't exist. There is no... At the federal level, or any publicly available tracking of violent crime, which would include robbery and burglary and car thefts and murder and etc., none of that is tracked and correlated with whether it's related to the drug war or drug trafficking. And so we don't keep these statistics, which is amazing considering we're spending $40 billion a year on the drug war and we keep statistics on everything in this country. Those figures aren't out there. Now, the FBI Uniform Crimes Reports do track a subcategory of murders that are related to narcotics. And it's only a fraction of what the real number would be for all the violent crime. So we were able to follow that. And the other problem with the figures is even though there were 14,000 murders in 2010, that's the most recent year available in the United States, some 35% of them don't have information attached to them to tell you what the causes were. So the data is pretty weak on this front, but we were able to pull out the narcotics-related murders and also makes, I think, some pretty reasonable assumptions about figuring out the likelihood of the unknown cases related to narcotics would be. Yeah, and the figure, and again, I think it's very conservative because we did not look at burglaries, we did not look at car thefts, we did not look at all the other violent crimes that lead to murder. In other words, if there was a murder that was related to a burglary, that's counted, but it doesn't tell you if it was related to the drug war or to drug smuggling or drug trafficking or someone on narcotics. It turns out the figure that we came up with from 2006 to 2010, which is roughly the period that the drug war escalated in Mexico, there's been 5,700 murders that are linked to the drug war in this country. So about 1,100 a year. And when you start looking around, it starts to add up. I mean, mentioned in the story that there were last year in Oakland, there were three little kids that were murdered by separate incidences by stray bullets in what would have been gang related activity, more likely. And a pregnant mother last year shot down in New York from some similar activity. And these are the stats that we see a headline about and forget, and we don't keep them, we don't count them. And that's what the story is about, is trying to count up, what is the real murder rate as close as we can get to it related to the drug war in this country. Now, it doesn't compare to what's going on in Mexico. It's a country a third of our size, and they've had 50,000 plus murders in that time period linked to the drug war. But at the same time, the number of murders, that 5,700 figure is more a higher number than the number of U.S. troops that died in the Iraq War. And it's also higher, of course, than the number of troops that died in the Afghanistan War. It's very close to being higher than both. And likely is if you add in, all the numbers we threw off the table just because we wanted to take the most conservative approach. So that's what we're looking at. I think it's something that that's what the story looks at. I think it's something, that we should have more journalism on. We should be trying to, and we should demand that our government actually tracks this stuff.
Well, it is startling that there is no tracking of that figure. But once again, I think it goes to show that for whatever reason, obviously the system itself is invested in the perpetuation of this drug war. And it may be for real politic, as you indicated, or nefarious purposes, as people like Sally Castillo have indicated. But at any rate, the drug war seems to be going along without any seeming any real resistance happening. In your opinion, what do you think needs to happen, or what can the average person do to try to affect this situation and try to bring some sort of halt to the incredible deaths that we're seeing in recent years?
Well, I think, we should maybe look south and see what's going on in Mexico right now with the mass nonviolent movement that's been organized over the past year and is still gaining momentum and steam down there. And essentially, what that's all about is standing up and demanding that some policies change, but also counting the dead and bringing the victims forward and putting faces on them and saying that the real consequence of this drug war is right next to you. It's not in the newspaper. It's happening in your neighborhood. It's happening to your friends. It's happening to your family. And bringing all those people together and organizing around some particular goals with some clear strategy and tactics. I mean, some good old fashioned, organizing. And that's what it's going to take. I mean, people are going to have to get back to what they used to do and what used to know how to do, at least, back, I hate to say it, back in the civil rights movement. I mean, that didn't happen by magic. That didn't happen because people spontaneously turned out signs and started yelling and the world changed. That was a lot of hard work, a lot of hard organizing and clear goals set in mind and people, pursuing strategy and staying on course with that strategy and having smart tactics and adjusting the tactics as they need to. It can happen. And it's happening in other places around the world. It's happening in the Middle East. It's happening in Mexico. It's just not happening here right now. And Occupy Wall Street might be the closest that we came to it, but that lacked, really a goal and, the strategy. It was like one tactic after another. But I think it showed there's a spark there. If that could be organized in a better way, I don't see why it couldn't happen here.
Well, on that hopeful note, Bill Conroy, narconews.com, thank you again for your time.
Thank you.